I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. 5 years ago today, Hurricane Sandy was moving up the east coast of the United States, eventually becoming the largest storm of the 2012 season. On October 29th, it made a left-hand turn and headed for the New Jersey shoreline. The strong winds downed power lines in New Jersey and New York, and severe flooding washed out streets, subways, and tunnels. More than 20 states, including Delaware, were affected before the storm headed west and was gone. In its wake was $70 billion in damage, thousands of people without homes, and 159 dead. This Sunday marks Superstorm Sandy's fifth anniversary. So today on Radio Times, what's the status of the recovery efforts? How are people, especially those who experience loss, coping? And how are we preparing for the next big storm, especially with what we are learning about sea level rise? I have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Amanda DeVecca-Rainier is founding director of the New Jersey Resource Project and the New Jersey Organizing Project. They have a new report called Long Road Home. Amanda DeVecca-Rainier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Next to her and sitting across from me is Patricia Finley. She's associate professor in the School of Social Work at Rutgers University. She's part of a research team that's been looking into the impact of Sandy on the health and well-being of New Jersey's children and families. Patricia Finley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Benjamin Horton. He's a professor at the Asian School of the Environment at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, also in the Department of Marine and Coastal Science at Rutgers University, and he's one of the authors of a new study published in the Academy of Sciences titled The Impact of Climate Change on New York City's Coastal Flood Hazard. Ben Horton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let me play something that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said on Monday talking about Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy.
The recovery from Sandy after 5 years in our short counties is complete. Now, that doesn't mean that every family's back in their home. But what it does mean is that we started with 365,000 homes that were damaged, and we're now at about 1,000 homes that still left need to be handled to get families back in. If you compare that to the recovery that went on post-Katrina in Louisiana and Mississippi, or you compare it even to what's happening across the Hudson River in New York, and we'll be talking more about these statistics as the week goes on. New Jersey has outpaced each one of those significantly.
Amanda, how would you describe recovery post-Sandy in New Jersey?
It is nowhere near complete, and it's a frustration for families in our communities that are still struggling to recover, and even those that have made it home but are still struggling with the recovery. When the governor says things like the recovery is complete, but not everyone's home, I don't understand. What Sandy recovery he sees is seeing. It's not the one that we're seeing on the ground. It's not the one our families are experiencing.
Well, you did a survey of a number of people in New Jersey about how they are experiencing recovery. How many people are still not home? And I guess by that, either back in the home that was destroyed or in a new home that they have built or purchased or are renting somewhere else?
So we don't, funny thing. And that, I think, makes it easy for the governor to make claims that are false, which is what that interview was. So there were over 300,000 homes that were damaged in the storm. Actually, that 365 number, there's been some research from reporters, Scott Gurian, who used to be at NJ Spotlight, that showed there's actually no basis for that number.
Mm. It is somewhere. Could be more, could be less.
I think it's a little bit less. It's over 300,000, but those are families that were impacted. Everyone was impacted. Whether you lost power and you lost all the food that you had in your refrigerator, whether you had some, you know, minor damage to your home. But when the governor wants to measure how many families are home, he needs to start with the number of families that had the kind of damage that meant they'd have to leave home. That number is closer to 40,000 primary homeowners, according to the state's own numbers. So what the state is tracking is, of those 40,000 families, there's a little bit less than 8,000 that are in their recovery program, the REM program, which is the state's $1.1 billion HUD-funded program to get families back home and whole. In that program, there are over 2,000 families that are not home and not recovered. Mm-hmm. So it's around 27% of that 8, not including that broader number. And what our survey showed, and again, that was a sample of Sandy impacted communities, but what we found was about 22% of the people that participated weren't home and were trying to get there.
After 5 years. Let me turn to you, Patricia, because mm-hmm. you and others have been talking to people who literally were affected by mm-hmm. Sandy, some of whom lost their homes, perhaps even lost loved ones, also mm-hmm. lost a kind of way of life. How are they coping?
I have to concur with what's being said here. We did an initial survey of 1,000 randomized individuals across the state of New Jersey in the 9 most affected counties, and we went back 2 years later over this past summer to then talk to people, to do focus groups and key informant interviews, and people are not home. People are still dealing with many of the issues that have been mentioned here already, ongoing mental health, physical health issues. They're so... In fact, one woman we interviewed, we were using hotels in some of the southern parts of the state to interview, and the woman walked across the parking lot from the hotel where she's been living the last 5 years while she's waiting for her home to be rebuilt to come be part of our focus group. So people are still suffering.
Are these people that were in some ways vulnerable even before Sandy hit?
Oh, that's so interesting. There is a combination here that we've seen. We saw a lot of... Certainly low income, because part of a southern part of New Jersey is a lower income than the northern part, but a lot of middle class, and we were calling them the new needy, people who are not used to dealing with social service system or talking to the government for additional help. So there needed to be some work around helping them learn to accept help. So that was a big struggle for them. And then when they did lose things, it was a greater impact. We saw people digging into the college funds to pay for homes, retirement homes that are out devastated, retirement investments that are devastated now to pay for their homes. So their financial security is gone.
Ben, let me get you in on the conversation. Your area of expertise is sea level rise, its impact on the environment. What did Sandy tell us about sea level rise?
Well, Sandy illustrated the importance of sea level rise in contributing to flooding. So Hurricane Sandy was an unusual event. It had an unusual track in that it veered westward to make landfall in northern New Jersey. It had an unusual size. It was very large and it was slow moving, which meant during the course of landfall it coincided with high tide. But it occurred upon a rising baseline, and that baseline was sea level. And sea level in 2012, when it made landfall, was the highest it had been for about 120,000 years on the Jersey Shore.
120,000 years.
Yeah, since last interglacial. And so sea level rise dominates coastal flooding. If we think about the research that we've been doing, so we've had a series of papers that looks at flooding in New Jersey and New York City in the past, present and future. So we can look at a timeline of how flooding has changed. And as we move into the future, although we're, as a community, as a scientific community, uncertain about the occurrence of landfalling hurricanes, one thing we are certain about is that sea level is going to rise. Mm.
So whether there are hurricanes or not, or if they're offshore or onshore, we're still dealing with sea level rise.
Yeah, so the latest paper that you made mention to sort of has a good news, bad news element to it. So to do with hurricanes, well, one of the given in science is that if you warm ocean waters, the hurricanes will become more intense or become stronger, but we are uncertain about whether they will make landfall. Mm-hmm. And our study illustrated that although we'll get more intense hurricanes and they'll be of a larger size, they'll have a track that will veer offshore. So if a hurricane makes its way up the Atlantic coast, it's more likely to go offshore than make landfall. So that's the good news about it.
Right.
But however, the bad news is that sea level is going to rise. And some of the facts that we come out with is that sea level is likely to rise about 11 inches by 2030. And that has a huge impact on storm surge height. So as I said, we have a timeline now. So if we look at like a 7.4-foot flood, that was a 1 in 500-year occurrence prior to the Industrial Revolution. Today, it's around 1 in every 25 years, and by 2030, it's 1 in every 5 years.
So just the fact we're going to deal
They're
with this
be
on
more
a
and
more
frequent.
Regular basis.
And as we move to the end of the century, it occurs approximately every mm-hmm. year.
I want to pick up on that, but I want to go back to you, Amanda. Something like $70 billion was earmarked. Now, we're talking about more than New Jersey. Where did that money go? And I realize it's federal money. Some of it is state money. It's kind of a mix of dollars there. But Do we know? That's a lot of money. Do we know where it went?
That's a lot of money. I don't know. And I'm not sure if anyone knows, but I think that's a really important question. And, you know, I think as many people know, New Jersey is close to electing a new governor. And I think that's a really important question for New Jersey's next governor. Is there funding there that hasn't been distributed? And how can we redirect that to helping people get across the finish line who are not home yet? And then helping people that are suffering, like Patricia said. I mean, our survey also found many people reporting mental health issues, stroke, asthma, and 19% of the people that answered our survey have an increased dependence on alcohol and drugs now. Mm. And I appreciate their honesty, but there are very few services anymore around Sandy. And in fact, it's hard to find mental health and treatment services anyway, even if you're not going just for the storm. So I think there's more we can do, and I hope we're going to be able to do that.
I want to go back to you, Patricia, only because Samantha was talking about some of these mental health stresses. Did you also look at the systems created to deal with people under this kind of stress and duress?
Yes. Excuse me. We had funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to look at the behavioral health response, the services response to the communities early on. And we found a lot of fragmentation. We found a lot of issues in the timing of the services. There's a lot of immediate services, and then they went away. So we need a lot more work around the metrics that look at the recovery process. How long do services need to stay in place? And that's a concern. And the fragmentation of services were part of the problem. Where they were placing the services, there wasn't a lot of thought, I think, placed into where they put the generators for the cell phones, where they put the first aid stations, where they put the shelters. So there were some concerns about that as well.
When you talk about services, do people need therapy? They need counseling? They need advice? They need money?
Yes. You know, when we talk about services, certainly Maslow's hierarchy of needs is very important. So basic food is important, food and shelter, lots of blankets and pillows and socks were being distributed. But certainly people who had mental health issues and were on medication, Red Cross physicians are not so willing to write for a psychotropic medication. And during storms like this, when we had no electricity, the CVSs and the Duane Reads, we didn't have electronic communication to look at prior prescriptions. So it became a complex problem for people with significant mental health issues. Then we got just to anxiety, depression, not to minimize that. But there's a lot of stress that goes on, and sure, you're in a shelter with a lot of stimulation. It's like a pressure cooker for those individuals. And a lot of people with severe mental illness left. They went into the Pine Barrens. They got out into the outside community because they couldn't be in those environments. It was too stressful for them.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, 5 years hence, talking with Patricia Finley, Benjamin Horton, and Amanda DeVecca-Rainier. And we're talking with you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tell us your Sandy story. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about the fact that it's been 5 years since Hurricane Sandy wreaked havoc on New Jersey and the East Coast shoreline. We're talking about the state of recovery, sea level rise, whether the state is prepared for the next big storm, and how people are coping. And again, our guests are Patricia Finley. She's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Rutgers University, Benjamin Horton, professor at the Asian School of the Environment at Nanjing Technological University in Singapore, also in the Department of Marine and Coastal Science at Rutgers University, and Amanda DeVecca-Rainier, founding director of the New Jersey Resource Project and the New Jersey Organizing Project. And again, you can join us with your story about Sandy, 1-888-477-9499. Let me go back to you, Amanda, if I could. I'm thinking about those people who are not home yet. Why not? I mean, what have been the problems that have prevented people from going to what they would consider to be a home?
Yeah, and there are multiple failures. And for some people, every sort of system that was going to break down broke down for them. And so people struggled through the recovery, but then maybe got hit with another disaster in the recovery. And I think, you know, not having stable housing for 5 years really impacts people both economically and physically. So first, we had the National Flood Insurance Program. About 78% of the folks in our survey had flood insurance. A lot of people that were impacted by the storm in New Jersey did, but not everyone. Right. But the National Flood Insurance Program is administered, it sounds like it's public, kind of. It's administered by private insurance companies since the 80s when Reagan established what we call the Write Your Own program. And Congress does not do enough to rein in and regulate the abuses of the private insurance industry that have a pretty sweet deal in this program where they make money for administering it but put taxpayer money out when they're paying claims. So people were really chronically and systemically underpaid. Not everyone, but a lot of people.
And so you have to know how to work the system, too.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't have to, but you do have to. And so actually the claims were so sort of bad, both in New York and New Jersey, and fraudulent engineering reports are being filed, that every Sandy claim was reopened. So people could go back and file again. And that was helpful for many people who were trying to put together enough funds to get across the finish line, which is one of the problems people have now. As it's dragged on, it's gotten more expensive. They've had to spend money that they got from insurance for rent or for storage or for transportation because their job is far away from where they ended up. So the flood insurance program was a challenge. Then the state's recovery program, REM, which was for homeowners, was also a challenge. And actually, the state had to fire the first contractor that it hired to run that program. People complained about, you know, lost paperwork, not hearing back multiple times. And I think people should have been in that program that, in fact, weren't, just because that firm did such a bad job. And then once that got rolling, and this was really slow, you started to find some towns were moving more swiftly than others to help people with permits and variances. People got contractors, some of whom walked away with gigantic chunks of money and did little or no work, or work that was dangerous. And then people started to fall behind on mortgages and rent. What we found that I think was actually pretty amazing was that like 56% of people were having a hard time affording gas and food and bills after the storm. So it's just been layer upon layer for many people that they've had to battle through to get back, and they're not finished fighting, and they need a hand.
Let me turn to you, Ben, and I'm thinking about those more resort shore towns, and if you go along they're part of these barrier islands, if you go along the road there, you see mansions, frankly, sitting very close to the ocean. What's the future, do you think, for those properties, for that real estate?
Well, I mentioned the uncertainty, should I say, about hurricanes, but sea level rise is one of the more certain impacts of global warming. You know, global sea level rise is related to temperature. You increase temperatures of our oceans, they expand. You increase temperatures, you may melt ice on our ice sheets, ice caps and glaciers, and they make their way into the water. New Jersey itself is more susceptible to sea level rise than many other places on the earth. It could be thought of as a hot spot for a variety of factors. The land is sinking in New Jersey. It's sinking in New Jersey from an extinct ice sheet. It's a long, non-climatic process. It's sinking in New Jersey because we are withdrawing groundwater. In the oceans, there's variability associated with the Gulf Stream. So climate projections suggest that the Gulf Stream will slow down in the future, so that will pile water up in the New Jersey area. So all properties, whether you're rich or poor, are going to be influenced by this. And people have to make a variety of decisions about how they adapt to the coastline. Do they defend against it, building seawalls or building coastal dunes? Do they adapt to live with it by raising their houses on stilts so they can live whenever the high tides, or do they retreat?
Those are the options.
And you can't defend all coastlines, so you're going to have to look at the other two, whether you live with it or whether you retreat. And that's going to be a hard decision for anyone. But one thing I'd like to add, I mean, if we listen to the other two speakers, I mean, the impact of Hurricane Sandy was devastating. And whatever the numbers are that Chris Christie talks about of 300,000 people, that's devastating. And I think that most people think that Hurricane Sandy was a one-off. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, yes, it was. If we go back to those numbers, I said one in 500 years. That means once in every seven generations does an event of such magnitude occur. When we look into the future, we're talking 2030. I mean, that's, 13 years away.
Right.
We're talking about an event of a similar magnitude occurring once every 5 years. So the devastation that we see could be a regular occurrence. And that is what's so scary about the underlying baseline, which is climate change.
And as the three of you were talking, I'm thinking about Puerto Rico, and we've done several shows about that. But that's, I would say, hanging over all of this. Patricia, let me turn to you. And I'm thinking about children. And I'm also thinking about something that we learned, I think, from Katrina and perhaps from Sandy as well, which is that when people retreat, they want to take their pets with them. And I wonder if we could talk a bit about children and pets and Sandy and recovery.
Absolutely. Pets is certainly a big part of lives for many individuals, not only just children, but also elderly. And that was another impacted population in this hurricane, is that elderly really, when they're in their communities, rely on their communities for their social support. They know their library is, their grocery stores, but when you uproot that, it changes their mental health state. Children, I wanted to speak briefly about that because we had the opportunity to follow these kids. We saw them in 2013-14. We went back to do interviews with them just this past summer, and we saw that children who experienced minor damage in their home, just minor damage, right, were four times more likely to be sad or depressed than those who had no damage. And they're also twice as likely to have sleeping issues. Following up with them 5 years later, these were kids who were 10, 11, 12, 13, are now 18. What was it like for them now?
Right.
They're still holding in a lot of their feelings. They're trying not to burden their parents. The parents are having financial situations that they can't manage. The kids are not participating in sports after school. They're changing their college plans. And we specifically asked children about, when was recovery for you? How did you know you were recovered? Some didn't feel they were recovered. We asked their parents that as well. But a lot of kids recovered when they got back to school. But many kids, because of the way the storm hit, there were a few kids in some areas that might have been impacted in a certain school. It might have been a whole other school. Those onesie, twosies in their own school didn't receive the support that they did that was the larger groups. And those children are still experiencing mental health issues.
What do they want? I mean, they want to be able to talk about it, to process it, to have someone understand what this meant for them?
You know, it's interesting to talk about that because during the focus groups, they were starting to talk. A lot of times they shun that kind of communication. We asked them who they saw as a mentor. Is there a coach, a teacher, a religious member that they could talk to? And a lot of kids just did not speak.
Oh. Which tells you something.
Yeah.
Kids don't speak.
That's why we're concerned about that drug and alcohol abuse that you mentioned earlier, Amanda.
Let me get some callers in. We've got some comments as well, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Talking about Hurricane Sandy, 5 years after it landed in New Jersey, and of course it affected a number of states along the eastern seaboard and even in inland as well. We've got Joe, and Joe is calling us from Little Egg Harbor in New Jersey. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I called about 5 years ago to your program about the moral hazards of flood insurance.
Yep.
And I'm still out of my house. I'm still dealing with the bureaucracy of the contractors that handled the Sandy recovery. They've lost my paperwork. I'm paying for two houses. It's a bureaucratic nightmare.
Oh,
and I really resent the fact that Governor Christie is taking credit for a recovery that never happened. In fact, I reached out to his office and during the Bridgegate scandal, and they were really unable to help. They acted like they were going to help, and then the scandal hit, and I was left hanging, trying to deal with the bureaucracy that really didn't seem to care about solving the problem. They just cared about pushing paperwork around.
The whole
community is really in the same situation.
And we're talking about Little Egg Harbor, are we, Joe?
Yeah, Little Egg Harbor. I've had a lot of senior citizens that have left the area. They just couldn't deal with the stress. Several have passed away because of contractors that that stole from them. There's a lot of empty lots. We're trying to recover, but I don't know where the money went from the all the federal money. But,
you know, Joe,
it certainly didn't. Yeah,
no, I hear you. And the reason I'm jumping in here is that I see people nodding their head, including Amanda. I've heard the word contractor several times, and we're only about half an hour into the program. Can you, Amanda, can you help Joe?
Hey, Joe. I'm from Cedar Bonnet Island. If you're from Little Lake Harbor, you may actually know where that is. Yeah, hi, are you in the REM program? Are you getting rental assistance, or no, are you not in the REM program?
I was in the REM program. I was dropped out due to a technicality, lost paperwork. It actually came down to a voting registration that was motor vehicles never corrected, and I lost my grant because of that.
Wow.
And I hired an attorney. I can't afford an attorney anymore, and now the whole thing is just in limbo. Wow. My house is substantially damaged. Only because I had to do that in order to get the grant.
Yeah,
now I don't have the grant, and I'm nowhere.
What Joe is saying about a substantial damage letter. Joe lives in a Back Bay community, and I think a lot of times we talk about, you know, the barrier islands. Those are the more vivid images, but I bet Benjamin can talk about the way that flooding and sea level rise will affect not only the barrier islands, but the Back Bay and lagoon communities, and that's where we have a lot of calls and conversations. Joe. So you hired an attorney, and if you weren't able to get back into the REM program, who knows, but if we do have a new governor and there is remaining funding, that is a shot to kind of go back and say, look, many people were left out of this that didn't do anything wrong and really should not have been. I don't know if you want to, our office is in West Creek. You're welcome to stop by and hang out with us. I can give you my cell phone number, or you can find us on Facebook.
Well, you know what, Joe? Let's get your number off the air, and we'll try to hook you up with Amanda and see if we can get some progress on your crisis there. And Ben, you want to talk about those more inland water bodies?
Unlike oceanfront flooding, which attracts the news because you have crashing waves pounding the shore, Back Bay flooding occurs gradually and comparatively quietly as sea level rises, and this effect is obviously worsened by storms. The problem with Back Bay flooding is that engineering solutions that are applicable to the ocean side are not applicable. So on the ocean side, we build barriers or we replenish our beaches. But on the back barrier, those solutions aren't there. The traditional or the natural solutions are coastal wetlands. Traditionally, the Back Bay areas had large amounts of coastal wetlands, and they act as a sponge in absorbing the rising waters. And coastal wetlands themselves have the ability to build vertically as sea level rises, naturally protecting the shoreline. But in the back barriers, we've removed many of the coastal wetlands. We build right along the shore.
And that creates the kind of problem, I guess, that Joe,
yes.
He's dealing with bureaucracy and perhaps contractors that didn't do what they were supposed to do, but then that's the environmental.
Yes, and so that goes back to one of my earlier sort of comments about that, you know, you have to live with the shoreline. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it is trying to regenerate our coastal marshes to act as the buffer in these back barrier communities.
You know, Patricia, I'm thinking about, and there's the bureaucracy, there's the government, there's the science, there's the programs, but what home means to people, and I think for some people their life is changed, is permanently changed because of Sandy. We're seeing that again, you know, in Puerto Rico, for instance. But how do you help people adjust to that, to say, this is your future, that was your past, this is your future?
Yeah, that's really difficult. And we want to make sure that they do get the mental health services that they need. I think going forward, though, we need to plan better so we can respond more quickly. Destigmatize applying for services. That's probably the most important thing. Again, some of these people, as I said, the new needy, they're not used to applying. And what we call push services to go out into the community, take Meals on Wheels out into the community before they have to call for them. Put people out who are trusted institutions. Firefighters are well known in the community. They're trusted, for example. They could carry out information. We know the government was not seen kindly during this process, so a lot of mistrust, distrust was happening with these individuals. Even us as researchers were not trusted coming to the doors.
So certainly outsiders, though, in a way?
Absolutely. But the Mental Health Association of New Jersey is there. There are programs, and there's hotlines for those people to reach out to. But certainly, if you're feeling sad, depressed, or even like your world has changed and you can't put it quite back together again, don't sit alone. Reach out. Because we did find out that talking certainly is helping. And going forward, we'd recommend that parents and children be brought together to talk about recovery instead of separating them. Because when we brought them together, they could recover as a family. And we did not see that happening as much in this process as we'd hoped.
I mean, is our fraudulent contractors or scam artists, was that part of what has made recovery as difficult as it is for some?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's like the fourth or fifth thing that came along to make recovery difficult, but oh my goodness.
Really?
Yeah, and sometimes it was out-of-state contracts or storm chasers that came in, and because we track these by business, right, you can just file for a new LLC, and you can't really, even if people had been arrested or charged, we don't actually have a way to stop this from happening. And I think, you know, there's sort of no excuse for that. The lessons we've learned, as this becomes a more regular thing, we have to implement them. It's just no reason for people to suffer the way we have. And then even some neighborhood contractors. I mean, we had one member who hired the guy that was the local soccer coach, and all he did was cut and cap, which is to say shut off his utilities and walk off with $50,000.
Oh my God.
And he just got home a couple months ago, our member, because of that.
Because of that. And we're talking, again, almost 5 years.
So contractors were not vetted enough in the REM program. We have to do something better than what we've done there.
We're going to take another short break and then talk about lessons learned and what to do and how to prevent some of the problems that resulted as a result of Sandy's impact on New Jersey. We are focusing largely on New Jersey, but of course, Sandy affected a number of communities in other states and including New York as well. That's Amanda DeVecca-Rainier, and she's founding director of the New Jersey Resource Project and the New Jersey Organizing Project. Ben Horton is a professor at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, also at Rutgers University, and Patricia Finley, associate professor in the School of Social Work, also at Rutgers University. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I do want to say on the air what we were talking about off the air, because we can walk away from a show like this feeling like gloom and doom, and there is no future. Can you talk a little bit, Patricia, and Ben, you also mentioned this as well, about PTSD growth or social growth, that there are things people can learn and even grow from when dealing with adversity.
And certainly, we talked about PTSD as a negative response to trauma, but there's post-traumatic growth that people can actually find within their own resilience some strength and actually feel stronger psychologically, even physically, after experiencing this. I know, Ben, you were mentioning social capital is another term.
In Singapore.
Well, social capital, what you can compare is how different nations deal with disasters. So I was heavily involved after the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, which killed hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia and beyond. But they have immense social capital, i.e. they build on their neighbours and friends, and they have relatively limited support from the government. But they're able to rebuild and respond and have a community that is the same or in actual fact greater than previously. So that's the sort of an institutional memory within the community.
And so, I mean, it's people doing it for themselves and each other.
Yeah, it's important. I want to be clear. We're not minimizing post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety or depression or those negative reactions, but just to say that people could have a positive reaction, and sometimes they feel guilty, survivor's guilt, feeling guilty for feeling like they're doing better after an event like this. So there's a whole range of emotions that come out of this.
You know, Amanda, is it your grandfather or your father lost a home, right?
Yeah, my father.
Your father lost a home.
I live next door to my dad. I live in my grandmother's home, actually, and And we have a little family compound on Cedar Bonnet Island, yeah. But he lost his house, but he is thankfully rebuilt in a home. And that's part of my experience, actually, in helping to start these organizations, was watching our friends and neighbors and communities come together to support each other while simultaneously these systems were not helping us. And I just thought, well, we just need to get together and push those systems to do what we need. And actually, it's because of the organizing of many Sandy-impacted communities that we got a rental assistance program when the state was planning to stop after 2 years, because, as the governor said, everything was fine. We really pushed the governor to pass foreclosure legislation so that people can get a break from their mortgage or not lose their homes. We're having a hard time. Some banks are following the law, some are not, but that strength that's in our community is what has helped get us through so far, and what we're going to need to think about: how do we want to respond to more frequent storms and more frequent flooding? We've got to be the deciders and come together as a community to address these questions.
Let me read a comment from David. He said, I noticed how the library in my county became a center for comfort. It gave access to heat for people in need, but also, I'm assuming, Patricia, community in a way. I mean, you can share horror stories with your neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that food was provided in some libraries. It was a place you could plug your cell phone in. I saw people doing work. They brought printers and laptops in. They had daycare in some communities within the libraries. The local communities did a pretty good job. The local mayors really did come together. Again, the faith-based groups had food pantries. A lot of on-the-ground community organizing was seen during this process.
You know, Ben, you were describing the options that we have. I mean, we can just continue as we do and just bear the consequences. We can figure out some technological fixes, I guess. We can retreat. Do we have time?
Well, I mean, regarding the future of the Jersey Shore, or really any shore anywhere around the globe, we have to have adaptation measures, so how we change our coastline to better deal with disasters, but we also need to mitigate against climate change. Without reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, all bets are off. Adaptations could be on the coastline relatively useless. And this is becoming increasingly clear if we look at the latest projections based upon observations of what our ice sheets are doing. So when you talk about sea level rise, yes, your oceans can expand. Yes, you can get melting from glaciers. But the big danger are our ice sheets. I mean, if we just think about Antarctica, Antarctica has 65 meters of water within it, over 200 feet of possible sea level rise. And so only a small percentage of that ice sheet needs to melt to cause devastating consequences. And we have really two clear scenarios now for the future. You can use a low emission scenario, basically what the Paris Agreement was all about, or you can burn, baby, burn and just have the normal emission scenario. And the differences in sea level rise for New Jersey is quite staggering. So in New Jersey, under a high emission burn, baby, burn scenario, you get around 5 to 6 feet of sea level rise by 2100.
In almost 80 years.
However, in the Paris Accord, you only get 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise. And so there's a clear difference between that. And then to get those rates of rise, you need to think about rates. And so the rate under a high emission scenario is about an inch a year. And under those rates, marshes can't keep pace. All your marshes basically disappear. You can kiss goodbye to the barrier islands because they just cannot withstand that type of increase in rate and the removal of sand from your shore face. Conversely, if you do a low emission scenario, you're getting a raise of around an inch a decade, not much more than today. And I would say that we would therefore be able to continue to work along our shorelines. We'd be able to continue to live along our shorelines. The ecosystems would flourish. So regarding the future, it's not all doom and gloom. Right. We have a choice. It's a very clear choice, and therefore we have hope. We either do something about greenhouse gas emissions and we stick to the Paris Accord, which every other country, apart from the United States, except for Syria, is in that agreement.
Well, we have done whole shows related to what you just said there, Ben, and I just let that hang out there and we can all think about it. Let me get Fran from, looks like, Fort Washington to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Fran. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show.
Thanks.
I wondered about follow-up when there's poor management of a catastrophe, not just Sandy, but in other places where there's unscrupulous contractors coming in. What is the follow-up in terms of litigation and in terms of sanctions so that it makes people that want to take advantage of a disaster think twice because there are consequences?
Fran, I'm going to toss that to Amanda, and anyone else can weigh in as well.
Hey, Fran, right now we're not doing enough. Part of what happens is if you sometimes it's hard to find a lawyer that will even take on the case to sue the contractors because the contractors are going to declare bankruptcy and then that attorney is going to get 30% of nothing. So that's not always the best way to try to get enough funds to get home and get whole. We need to do better at this than we're currently doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling in, Fran. A comment from Monica. Great discussion today. My friend is a pastor for the Methodist Church Council and a talented contractor who has mobilized an army of volunteers and donations and sweat and tears and all the rest to help these people who are cheated, overlooked, and still in need of a secure shelter. So, yeah, go ahead.
There are some great nonprofit builders. Some are faith-based and some are not. And they're still going, and they're actually still helping people that are dealing with contractor fraud. But philanthropic dollars are sort of waning 5 years after the storm at a time when we need them most to get people across the finish line. So groups like that, they need our ongoing support.
I'm thinking, Patricia, this Sunday marks the anniversary. It's not something anyone would celebrate, but it's we mark it. It's one of the reasons we're doing the program. Mm-hmm. What's the healthy way to remember Sandy or to even mark that day?
I guess, first of all, really being aware of it. I think a lot of reminders between 9/11 and Harvey and Irma and all of the other disasters in Puerto Rico going on right now, constantly flooding the individual. Take time for yourself. Really think about what's happening to you. If you feel like you are sad or depressed, reach out. Talk to friends and families. Stay away from the TV. Stay away from the Internet. Really, those images are just going to be bombarding us during that time.
The news organizations will be reliving all of that.
Absolutely. And we know children, particularly, we think they're more resilient than they are. They're very vulnerable. We need to protect children. And sometimes they do regress to lower developmental stages during this time. So you know, pay attention and take care of yourself. Enjoy family or friends.
And what about you, Amanda?
It's going to be storming, I think, unless the weather changes on Sunday, which
is
going to make it even
ironic,
harder.
Right?
Yeah, we get a lot of, I have anxiety, right, when we have nor'easters and storms and flooding. We're actually going to be gathering in the homes of families that are still struggling in Atlanta County, then in Ocean County, and then in Monmouth County. So we're just trying to get people together to talk about where we are and be together on that day.
Are there certain parts of New Jersey that are lagging behind other parts when it comes to recovery, or is it more diverse?
It's hard to tell, yeah.
Yeah.
The answer to that is probably yes, but yeah.
Right. Let me get Robert from Eastwick to join us. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to all your guests. I had a question living here in a river community. The FEMA flood maps show that all of Eastwick, Kingsessing, Tinicum Township, the airport, all of that area has less than 30 years before it will be underwater. Hmm. Now, there was a series of town meetings held down at the Jersey Shore, but nothing like that has been conducted here in the immediate Philadelphia community. And I can tell you, as an environmental preservationist, the Tinica Marsh, which used to protect the city and the area, has been so downsized and degraded, it will never be able to contend with what's coming. So my question is, Pepper Middle School is at below sea level at 84th and Lindbergh Boulevard. Is it not now time to start having community meetings here to evaluate what's coming?
Robert, I'm going to put your question, I'm going to put that to you, Ben.
Well, I think, again, it returns to a previous question about, we get a lot of publicity about what's happening in the ocean front, and as a result of that there was a lot of sand replenishment, and then there were debates about coastal dunes and living shorelines, but large areas of the coastline and the inland waterways are affected by sea level rise. And so the Philadelphia region, the airport, the marsh, are all influenced by it. And so there needs to be a sort of a holistic approach to understanding the threats in different areas. And then, you know, what are they going to be the impacts? Do we need to invest in our infrastructure? Do we need to protect our shorelines? Do we need to live with our shorelines, or do we live to retreat? You know, the coastal marshes, I think that many people don't understand how important they are. I mean, they act as fisheries, so that's important for commercial stock. They filter terrestrial water runoff and the pollutants, and following Hurricane Sandy, huge amounts of pollutants were remobilized into our system because of the storms, and there were incredible medical complications associated with that. They sequester carbon, so they suck carbon out of the atmosphere and store it in their soils, and then they buffer our shorelines. Right. So there are many impacts, but this is while we stick our heads quite literally in the sands and we don't deal with it, the problem gets worse year on year.
Is there a country you think that is being more proactive than this one?
Well, many countries. Well, in the US, the debate about climate change is quite keen, but we have an unbelievable number of activists on the ground informing people, trying to get policy made. In the US, we have more climate scientists than anywhere else in the world, so we can give the best possible informed decisions. In the US, we invest more money in climate change. So the US should actually be the best prepared, should be leading the charge on climate change, especially as the US is perhaps one of the more susceptible countries. We can see that with a variety of natural disasters that this country has faced in this summer alone. You know, people, like we talked to Joe earlier.
Yes.
I mean, I would say he's a victim of climate change. And the residents of Texas from Harvey are a victim of climate change. The residents of Florida from Irma are a victim of climate change. Residents in California from the wildfires are victims of climate change. So we need to address that problem, and then we can adapt properly.
There's a new phrase, climate refugee. I mean, which has worldwide implications. We're almost out of time here. Any final words from you, Amanda, as you look forward in New Jersey about what needs to be done, what can be done, what should be done?
I'm just really hopeful that as we have a new administration, that we'll get some new leadership, both to help us face and prepare for future storms and to address the way that climate change is impacting our health and our financial well-being as families in the state.
How about for you, Patricia?
Yeah, along with the lead investigator, David Abramson from NYU's College of Global Public Health, who was lead on this study, we're looking towards trying to reach out to help Harvey and Irma in Puerto Rico, those victims, taking lessons learned from New Jersey and moving forward, but continuing to work in New Jersey on our survivors here.
Well, it almost sounds like, picking up what you had said earlier, Patricia, is that doing something, being proactive, not just helps other people, but also can be healing for oneself.
Absolutely. We certainly know that that is healing.
We're going to end on that note. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Patricia Finley, thank you for driving 2.5 hours to be here on the show. I really do appreciate that. She's associate professor in the School of Social Work at Rutgers University. Ben Horton, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor at the Asian School of the Environment at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, also in the Department of Marine and Coastal Science at Rutgers University. And Amanda Devika-Rainier, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Founding director of the New Jersey Resource Project and the New Jersey Organizing Project, they have a new report. It's called Long Road Home. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.